Hello, I'm Bill Hartley, president of Audio Renaissance, and I'm very pleased to introduce you to our presentation of The Hero's Journey, Volume 1 of Joseph Campbell's landmark bestseller, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. If you're one of the great many devotees who know and love this classic work, I can assure you that you'll find this recording to be not only faithful to the spirit of the book, but also a wonderfully enjoyable way to re-experience the insights and the poetic eloquence of one of the most lucid and original thinkers of our time. If this recording of Hero is your first exposure to Joseph Campbell's writing, you're in for a rare treat. As we produced these tapes, we took great care to maintain the integrity of Joseph Campbell's vision while preserving the beauty with which he uses the English language. Ralph Blum does a masterly job of making sure that the sense of the ideas doesn't get lost in the poetry of the written word. And, when it was possible, we've let Joseph Campbell speak for himself. Throughout this recording, we've included excerpts from various seminars featuring Joseph Campbell, recorded live, as he elaborates on the significance of certain myths, legends, and concepts written about in the text of the book. And now, I'm very pleased to introduce The Hero's Journey from The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell, narrated by Ralph Blum.
Whether we listen with aloof amusement to the dreamlike mumbo-jumbo of some red-eyed witch-doctor of the Congo, or read with cultivated rapture thin translations from the sonnets of the mystic Lao Tse, crack the hard nutshell of an argument of Aquinas, or catch suddenly the shining meaning of a bizarre Eskimo fairy tale, it will be always the one shape-shifting yet marvelously constant story that we find, together with a persistent suggestion of more to be experienced than will ever be known or told. Throughout the inhabited world, in all times and under every circumstance, the myths of man have flourished, and they have been the living inspiration of whatever else may have appeared out of the activities of the human body and mind. It would not be too much to say that myth is the secret opening through which the inexhaustible energies of the cosmos pour into human cultural manifestation. Religions, philosophies, arts, the social forms of primitive and historic man, prime discoveries in science and technology, the very dreams that blister sleep, boil up from the magic ring of myth. The wonder is that the characteristic ability to touch and inspire deep creative centers dwells in the smallest nursery fairy tale, as the flavor of the ocean is contained in a droplet, or the whole mystery of life within the egg of a flea. For the symbols of mythology are not manufactured. They cannot be ordered, invented, or permanently suppressed. They are spontaneous productions of the psyche, and each bears within it, undamaged, the germ power of its source. What is the secret of the timeless vision? From what profundity of mind does it derive? Why is mythology everywhere the same, beneath its varieties of costume? And what does it teach? Today, many sciences are contributing to the analysis of the riddle. Archaeologists are probing the ruins of Iraq, Honan, Crete, and Yucatan. Ethnologists are questioning the Ostiaks of the River Ob, the Bubis of Fernando Po. A generation of Orientalists has thrown open to us the sacred writings of the East, as well as the pre-Hebrew sources of our own Holy Writ. Another host of scholars in the field of folk psychology has been seeking to establish the psychological bases of language, myth, religion, art development, and moral codes. Most remarkable of all, however, are the revelations that have emerged from the mental clinic. The writings of the psychoanalysts are indispensable to the student of mythology. Freud, Jung, and their followers have demonstrated irrefutably that the logic, the heroes, and the deeds of myth survive into modern times. In the absence of an effective general mythology, each of us has his private yet secretly potent pantheon of dream. The latest incarnation of Oedipus, the continued romance of Beauty and the Beast, stand this afternoon on the corner of 42nd Street and 5th Avenue, waiting for the traffic light to change. The unconscious sends all sorts of vapors, odd beings, terrors, and deluding images up into the mind, whether in dream, broad daylight, or insanity. For the human kingdom, beneath the floor of the comparatively neat little dwelling that we call our consciousness, goes down into unsuspected Aladdin caves. There abide not only jewels, but dangerous genies, the inconvenient or resisted psychological powers that we have not thought or dared to integrate into our lives. They may remain unsuspected, or, on the other hand, some chance word, the smell of a landscape, the taste of a cup of tea, or the glance of an eye may touch a magic spring, and then dangerous messengers begin to appear in the brain. Dangerous because they threaten the fabric of the security into which we have built ourselves and our families. But they are fiendishly fascinating, too, for they carry keys that open the whole realm of the desired and feared adventure of the discovery of the self, destruction of the world in which we live and of ourselves within it, then a wonderful reconstruction of the bolder, cleaner, more spacious, more fully human life. That is the lure, the promise, and terror of these disturbing night visitors from the mythological realm that we carry within. Psychoanalysis, the modern science of reading dreams, has taught us to take heed of these unsubstantial images. Also, it has found a way to let them do their work. The dangerous crises of self-development are permitted to come to pass under the protecting eye of an experienced initiate in the lore and language of dreams, who then enacts the role and character of the ancient mystagogue, or guide of souls, the initiating medicine man of the primitive forest sanctuaries of trial and initiation. The doctor, then, is the modern master of the mythological realm, the knower of all the secret ways and words of potency. His role is precisely that of the wise old man of the myths and fairy tales, whose words assist the hero through the trials and errors of the weird adventure. He is the one who appears and points to the magic shining sword that will kill the dragon terror, tells of the waiting bride and the castle of many treasures, applies healing balm to the almost fatal wounds, and finally dismisses the conqueror back into the world of normal life. It has always been the prime function of mythology and rite to supply the symbols that carry the human spirit forward in counteraction to those constant human fantasies that tend to tie it back. In fact, it may well be that the very high incidence of neurosis today follows from the decline of such effective spiritual aid. We remain fixated to the unexorcised images of our infancy, and hence disinclined to the necessary passages of our adulthood. In the United States, the goal is not to grow old, but to remain young, not to mature away from mother, but to cleave to her. And so, while husbands are worshipping at their boyhood shrines, being the lawyers, merchants, or masterminds their parents wanted them to be, their wives, even after 14 years of marriage and 2 fine children, are still on the search for love, which comes to them under the makeup of the latest heroes of the screen. The psychoanalyst has to assert again the tried wisdom of the older, forward-looking teachers of the masked medicine dancers and the witch doctor circumcisers, whereupon we find that the ageless initiation symbolism is produced spontaneously by the patient himself at the moment of the release. Apparently there is something in these initiatory images so necessary to the psyche that if they are not supplied from without, through myth and ritual, they will have to be announced again through dream from within.
Each one brings the myth right out of himself. And what the analyst does is help you recognize it as the image carrier of your own affects, your own energies. The value of the psychiatrist is that he helps you to relate your own images to your own affect, to your own energy system. And the reason you're in trouble is that you don't realize this. Now, in the traditional societies, the images were supplied. The traditional mythology supplies the images, and you're supposed to have the affect. We're reversing that. The artist has an experience, and he seeks the images through which to communicate it or render it. And he doesn't say to somebody, you have to get this message. Well, some of them do, but those are the ones we don't want to talk about. He exhibits his work, and if you like it, fine. If you don't... And so there's a sort of community of people who have slightly similar myths. But then we'll allow other people to have their own myths, each to have his own freedom. This is exactly the point. It's an individual quest. No one ever had your dreams. You're in the dark forest every time you go to sleep. The only thing is that most of us leave our miracle down there and don't bring it up again.
Psychoanalysis Sigmund Freud stresses in his writings the passages and difficulties of the first half of the human cycle of life, those of our infancy and adolescence, when our sun is mounting toward its zenith. Carl Jung, on the other hand, has emphasized the crises of the second portion, when, in order to advance, the shining spear must submit to descend and disappear, at last, into the night womb of the grave. The normal symbols of our desires and fears become converted into their opposites, for it is then no longer life, but death that is the challenge. What is difficult to leave then is not the womb, but the phallus. Full circle, from the tomb to the womb, to the womb to the tomb, we come. An ambiguous, enigmatical incursion into the world of solid matter that is soon to melt from us like the substance of a dream. And looking back at what had promised to be our own unique, unpredictable, and dangerous adventure, all we find in the end is such a series of standard metamorphoses as men and women have undergone in every quarter of the world, in all recorded centuries, and under every odd disguise of civilization. The story is told, for example, of the great Minos, king of the island empire of Crete in the period of its commercial supremacy, how he hired the celebrated artist craftsman Daedalus to invent and construct for him a labyrinth in which to hide something of which the palace was at once ashamed and afraid. For there was a monster on the premises which had been born to Pasiphae, the queen. Minos the king had been busy, it is said, with important wars to protect the trade routes, and meanwhile Pasiphae had been seduced by a magnificent, snow-white, sea-born bull. It had been nothing worse, really, than what Minos' own mother had allowed to happen. Minos' mother was Europa, and it is well known that she was carried by a bull to Crete. The bull had been the god Zeus, and the honored son of that sacred union was Minos himself, now everywhere respected and gladly served. How then could Pasiphae have known that the fruit of her own indiscretion would be a monster, this little son with human body but the head and tail of a bull? Society has blamed the queen greatly, but the king was not unconscious of his own share of guilt. The bull in question had been sent by the god Poseidon long ago, when Minos was contending with his brothers for the throne. Minos had asserted that the throne was his by divine right, and had prayed the god to send a bull out of the sea as a sign. And he had sealed the prayer with a vow to sacrifice the animal immediately, as an offering and symbol of service. The bull had appeared, and Minos took the throne. But when he beheld the majesty of the beast that had been sent, and thought what an advantage it would be to possess such a specimen, he determined to risk a merchant substitution, of which he supposed the god would take no great account. Offering on Poseidon's altar the finest white bull that he owned, he added the bull from the sea to his herd. The Cretan Empire had greatly prospered under the sensible jurisdiction of this celebrated lawgiver and model of public virtue. Knossos, the capital city, became the luxurious, elegant center of the leading commercial power of the civilized world. The Cretan fleets went out to every isle and harbor in the Mediterranean. Cretan ware was prized in Babylonia and Egypt. The bold little ships even broke through the gates of Hercules to the open ocean, coasting then northward to take the gold of Ireland and the tin of Cornwall, as well as southward around the bulge of Senegal to remote Yoruba land and the distant marts of ivory, gold, and slaves. But at home, the queen had been inspired by Poseidon with an ungovernable passion for the bull, and she had prevailed upon her husband's artist craftsman, the peerless Daedalus, to frame for her a wooden cow that would deceive the bull, into which she eagerly entered, and the bull was deceived. She bore her monster, which, in due time, began to become a danger. And so Daedalus again was summoned, this time by the king, to construct a tremendous labyrinthine enclosure with blind passages in which to hide the thing away. So deceptive was the invention that Daedalus himself, when he had finished it, was scarcely able to find his way back to the entrance. Therein the Minotaur, half man, half bull, was settled, and he was fed thereafter on groups of living youths and maidens carried as tribute from the conquered nations within the Cretan domain. Thus, according to the ancient legend, the primary fault was not the queen's, but the king's, and he could not really blame her, for he knew what he had done. He had converted a public event to personal gain, whereas the whole sense of his investiture as king had been that he was no longer a mere private person. The return of the bull should have symbolized his absolutely selfless submission to the functions of his role. The retaining of it represented, on the other hand, an impulse to egocentric self-aggrandizement, And so the king, by the grace of God, became the dangerous tyrant Holdfast, out for himself. Just as the traditional rites of passage used to teach the individual to die to the past and be reborn to the future, so the great ceremonials of investiture divested him of his private character and clothed him in the mantle of his vocation. Such was the ideal, whether the man was a craftsman or a king. By the sacrilege of the refusal of the rite, however, the individual cut himself as a unit off from the larger unit of the whole community. And so the one was broken into the many, and these then battled each other, each out for himself, and could be governed only by force. The figure of the tyrant monster is known to the mythologies, folk traditions, legends, and even nightmares of the world, and his characteristics are everywhere essentially the same. He is the hoarder of the general benefit. He is the monster avid for the greedy rights of my and mine. The havoc wrought by him is described in mythology and fairy tales as being universal throughout his domain. This may be no more than his household, his own tortured psyche, or the lives that he blights with the touch of his friendship and assistance, or it may amount to the extent of his civilization. The inflated ego of the tyrant is a curse to himself and to his world, no matter how his affairs may seem to prosper. Self-terrorized, fear-haunted, the giant of self-achieved independence is the world's messenger of disaster, even though, in his mind, he may entertain himself with humane intentions. Wherever he sets his hand, there is a cry, if not from the rooftops, then, more miserably, within every heart, a cry for the redeeming hero, the carrier of the shining blade, whose blow, whose touch, whose existence will liberate the land. As T.S. Eliot tells us in The Wasteland, here one can neither stand, nor lie, nor sit. There is not even silence in the mountains, but dry, sterile thunder without rain. There is not even solitude in the mountains, but red, sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. The hero is the man of self-achieved submission. But submission to what? That precisely is the riddle that today we have to ask ourselves, for it is everywhere the primary virtue and historic deed of the hero to resolve. As Professor Arnold J. Toynbee indicates in his study of the laws of the rise and disintegration of civilizations, schism in the soul, schism in the body social, will not be resolved by any scheme of return to the good old days or by programs guaranteed to render an ideal projected future. Only birth can conquer death. The birth not of the old thing again, but of something new. Peace, then, is a snare. War is a snare. Change is a snare, permanence a snare. When our days come for the victory of death, death closes in. There is nothing we can do except be crucified and resurrected, dismembered totally, and then reborn. Theseus, the hero slayer of the Minotaur, entered Crete from without as the symbol and arm of the rising civilization of the Greeks. That was the new and living thing. But it is also possible for the principle of regeneration to be sought and found within the very walls of the tyrant's empire itself. Professor Toynbee uses the terms detachment and transfiguration to describe the crisis by which the higher spiritual dimension is attained that makes possible the resumption of the work of creation. The first step, detachment or withdrawal, consists in a radical transfer of emphasis from the external to the internal world. A retreat from the desperations of the wasteland to the peace of the everlasting realm that is within. But this realm, as we know from psychoanalysis, is precisely the infantile unconscious. It is the realm that we enter in sleep. We carry it within ourselves forever. All the ogres and secret helpers of our nursery are there, all the magic of childhood, and more important, all the life potentialities that we never managed to bring to adult realization. Those other portions of ourself are there. For such golden seeds do not die. If only a portion of that lost totality could be dredged up into the light of day, we should experience a marvelous expansion of our powers, a vivid renewal of life. We should tower in stature. Moreover, if we could dredge up something forgotten, not only by ourselves, but by our whole generation, or our entire civilization, we should become indeed the boon bringer, the culture hero of the day, a personage of not only local but world historical moment. In a word, the first work of the hero is to retreat from the world to zones of the psyche where the difficulties really reside, and there to clarify the difficulties, eradicate them, and break through to the undistorted, direct experience and assimilation of what Carl Jung has called the archetypal images. This is the process known to Hindu and Buddhist philosophy as viveka, discrimination. The archetypes to be discovered and assimilated are precisely those that have inspired throughout the annals of human culture the basic images of ritual, mythology, and vision. These eternal ones of the dream are not to be confused with the personally modified symbolic figures that appear in nightmare and madness to the still tormented individual. Dream is the personalized myth, myth the depersonalized dream. Both myth and dream are symbolic in the same general way of the dynamics of the psyche. But in the dream, the forms are quirked by the peculiar troubles of the dreamer, whereas in myth, the problems and solutions shown are directly valid for all mankind.
Jung's concept is that the dream, the unconscious, complements the conscious situation. And where the conscious situation is radically wrong, the dream offers a correction. So that the first thing the doctor has to do is find what the person's situation is to which the dream is talking, and then ask the person to associate with the object in pure consciousness, not free association, but what do you think of in relation to this image? When, however, a truly mythological image appears in the dream with which the person can have no personal associations, then you've hit another level of the unconscious, what he calls the collective unconscious. And that part of the dream can be interpreted tentatively, you know, or approximately, by comparative mythological studies. What he calls the amplification of the dream imagery by comparative studies. His notion is not that the dream is trying to hide something from you, as in the Freudian view, but the dream is trying to reveal something to you through a language, through a picture language that you don't know how to read. Well then, how do you read the language? Well, how would you break any cryptic script? The philological method of comparison. You know, when you receive a letter in a handwriting that you can't quite read and there's a word you can't decipher, you go back to see if there are any other letters that look like this one. Oh yes, that's a T. Oh, that's the way she's making her O's now. And all that kind of thing, so you put the word together. And so it is with the images in dream. If they are from the personal recollections, from the personal unconscious, the individual dreaming will have associations, and by amplifying these you can interpret the dream. But if it hits the collective level, the only way to interpret it is by mythological comparisons, because there what is talking is the biological inheritance. The unconscious is not only a reservoir of rejected personal experiences, it is also a source from the inherited impulses of the body. Every organ of the body has its impulse, and they're all pushing from within. And in that sense, you share your mythology with everyone else. These are the archetypes.
The hero is the man or woman who has been able to battle past his or her personal and local historical limitations to the generally valid, normally human forms. Such a one's visions, ideas, and inspirations come pristine from the primary springs of human life and thought. The hero has died as a modern man, but as eternal man, perfected, unspecific, universal man, he has been reborn. His second solemn task indeed, therefore, is to return then to us transfigured and teach the lesson he has learned of life renewed. What follows is taken from Frederick Pierce's book Dreams of Personality. I was walking alone around the upper end of a large city, through slummy, muddy streets lined with hard little houses. I did not know where I was, but liked the exploring. I chose one street which was terribly muddy and led across what must have been an open sewer. I followed along between rows of shanties and then discovered a little river flowing between me and some high, firm ground where there was a paved street. This was a nice, perfectly clear river flowing over grass. I could see the grass moving under the water. There was no way to cross, so I went to a little house and asked for a boat. A man there said, of course, he could help me across. He brought out a small wooden box, which he put on the edge of the river, and I saw at once that with this box I could easily jump across. I knew all danger was over, and I wanted to reward the man richly. In thinking of this dream, I have a distinct feeling that I did not have to go where I was at all, but could have chosen a comfortable walk along paved streets. I had gone to the squalid and muddy district because I preferred adventure, and having begun, I had to go on. When I think of how persistently I kept going straight ahead in the dream, it seems as though I must have known that there was something fine ahead, like that lovely grassy river and the secure, high, paved road beyond. Thinking of it in those terms, it is like a determination to be born, or rather to be born again, in a spiritual sense. It is remarkable that in this dream, the basic outline of the universal adventure of the hero is reproduced to the detail. The crossing first of the open sewer, then of the perfectly clear river flowing over grass, the appearance of the willing helper at the critical moment, and the high, firm ground beyond the final stream. These are the everlastingly recurrent themes of the wonderful song of the soul's high adventure. The dreamer is assisted across the water by the gift of a small wooden box, which takes the place in this dream of the more usual skiff or bridge. This is a symbol of her own special talent and virtue, by which she has been ferried across the waters of the world. We do not know what special contents the box would have revealed, but it is certainly a variety of Pandora's box, that divine gift of the gods to a beautiful woman, filled with the seeds of all the troubles and blessings of existence, but also provided with the sustaining virtue, hope. By this, the dreamer crosses to the other shore, and by a like miracle, so will each whose work is the difficult, dangerous task of self-discovery and self-development be portered across the ocean of life. It is only those who know neither an inner call nor an outer doctrine whose plight truly is desperate, that is to say, most of us today in this labyrinth without and within the heart. Alas, where is the guide, that fond virgin Ariadne, to supply the simple clue that will give us courage to face the Minotaur and the means then to find our way to freedom when the monster has been met and slain. Ariadne, the daughter of King Minos, fell in love with the handsome Theseus the moment she saw him disembark from the boat that had brought the pitiful group of Athenian youths and maidens to the Minotaur. She found a way to talk to him and declared that she would supply a means to help him back out of the labyrinth if he would promise to take her away from Crete with him and make her his wife. The pledge was given. Ariadne turned for help then to the crafty Daedalus, by whose art the labyrinth had been constructed. Daedalus simply presented her with a skein of linen thread, which the visiting hero might fix to the entrance and unwind as he went into the maze. It is indeed very little that we need, but lacking that, the adventure into the labyrinth is without hope. That little is close at hand. Most curiously, the very scientist who, in the service of the sinful king, was the brain behind the horror of the labyrinth, quite as readily can serve the purposes of freedom. But the hero heart must also be at hand. For centuries, Daedalus has represented the type of the artist-scientist, that curiously disinterested, almost diabolic human phenomenon, beyond the normal bounds of social judgment, dedicated to the morals not of his time, but of his art. He is the hero of the way of thought, single-hearted, courageous, and full of faith that the truth, as he finds it, shall make us free. And so now we may turn to him, as did Ariadne. The flax for the linen of his thread he has gathered from the fields of the human imagination. Centuries of husbandry, decades of diligent culling, the work of numerous hearts and hands have gone into the hackling, sorting, and spinning of this tightly twisted yarn. Furthermore, we do not even have to risk the adventure alone, for the heroes of all time have gone before us. The labyrinth is thoroughly known. We have only to follow the thread of the hero path, and where we had thought to find an abomination, we shall find a god. Where we had thought to slay another, we shall slay ourselves. Where we had thought to travel outward, we shall come to the center of our own existence. Where we had thought to be alone, we shall be with all the world. Tragedy and comedy. Happy families are all alike. every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. With these fateful words, Count Leo Tolstoy opened the novel of the spiritual dismemberment of his modern heroine, Anna Karenina. That distracted wife, mother, and blindly impassioned mistress threw herself beneath the wheels of the train, thus terminating with a gesture symbolic of what had already happened to her soul, her tragedy of disorientation. Modern romance, like Greek tragedy, celebrates the mystery of dismemberment, which is life in time. The happy ending is justly scorned as a misrepresentation, for the world as we know it, as we have seen it, yields but one ending. Death, disintegration, dismemberment, and the crucifixion of our heart with the passing of the forms that we have loved. The happy ending of a fairy tale, a myth, and the divine comedy of the soul is to be read not as a contradiction, but as a transcendence of the universal tragedy of man. The objective world remains what it was, but because of a shift of emphasis within the subject, is beheld as though transformed. Where formerly life and death contended, now enduring being is made manifest, as indifferent to the accidents of time as water boiling in a pot is to the destiny of a bubble, or as the cosmos to the appearance and disappearance of a galaxy of stars. Tragedy is the shattering of the forms and of our attachment to the forms. Comedy, the wild and careless, inexhaustible joy of life invincible. Thus, the two are the terms of a single mythological theme, the down-going and the upcoming, which together constitute the totality of the revelation that is life, which the individual must know and love if he is to be purged of the contagion of sin and death. In Ovid's Metamorphoses, we read, "All things are changing, nothing dies. The spirit wanders, comes now here, and occupies whatever frame it pleases. For that which once existed is no more, and that which was not has come to be. And so the whole round of motion is gone through again." And similarly, from the Bhagavad Gita, "Only the bodies of which this eternal, imperishable, incomprehensible self is the indweller are said to have an end." It is the business of mythology proper and of the fairy tale to reveal the specific dangers and techniques of the dark interior way from tragedy to comedy. Hence, the incidents are fantastic and unreal. They represent psychological, not physical, triumphs. Even when the legend is of an actual historical personage, the deeds of victory are rendered not in lifelike, but in dreamlike configurations. The point is not that such and such was done on earth. The point is that before such and such could be done on earth, this other, more important, primary thing had to be brought to pass within the labyrinth that we all know and visit in our dreams. The passage of the mythological hero may be overground, incidentally. Fundamentally, it is inward, into depths where resistances are overcome and forgotten powers are revivified for the transfiguration of the world. This deed accomplished, life no longer suffers hopelessly under terrible disaster, but with its cries of anguish, it becomes penetrated by an all-suffusing, all-sustaining love, and by a knowledge of its own unconquered power. Something of the light that blazes invisible within the abysses suddenly breaks forth with an increasing uproar. The dreadful mutilations are then seen as shadows only. Time yields to glory, and the world sings with the prodigious, angelic, but perhaps finally monotonous, siren music of the spheres. Like happy families, the myths and the worlds redeemed are all alike. The standard path of the mythological adventure of the hero is a magnification of the formula represented in the rites of passage. Separation, initiation, return, which might be named the nuclear unit of what James Joyce called in Finnegan's Wake the monomyth. A hero ventures forth from the world of common day into a region of supernatural wonder. Fabulous forces are there encountered, and a decisive victory is won. The hero comes back from this mysterious adventure with the power to bestow boons on his fellow man. Prometheus ascended to the heavens, stole fire from the gods, and descended. Jason sailed through the clashing rocks into a sea of marvels, circumvented the dragon that guarded the golden fleece, and returned with the fleece and the power to wrest his rightful throne from a usurper. Aeneas went down into the underworld, crossed the dreadful river of the dead, threw a sop to the three-headed watchdog Cerberus, and conversed at last with the shade of his dead father, and then returned through the ivory gate to his work in the world. A majestic representation of the difficulties of the hero task is presented in the traditional legend of the great struggle of the Buddha. The young prince, Gautama Sakyamuni, set forth secretly from his father's palace on the princely steed Kanthaka, passed miraculously through the guarded gate, rode through the night attended by the torches of 4 times 60,000 divinities, lightly hurdled a majestic river 1,128 cubits wide, and then, with a single sword stroke, sheared his own royal locks, whereupon the remaining hair, 2 finger breadths in length, curled to the right and lay close to his head. Assuming the garments of a monk, he moved as a beggar through the world, and during these years of apparently aimless wandering, acquired and transcended the 8 stages of meditation. He retired to a hermitage, bent his powers 6 more years to the great struggle, carried austerity to the uttermost, and collapsed in seeming death, but presently recovered. Then he returned to the less rigorous life of the ascetic wanderer. One day, he sat beneath a tree, contemplating the eastern quarter of the world, and the tree was illuminated with his radiance. A young girl named Tsuyata came and presented milk rice to him in a golden bowl, and when he tossed the empty bowl into a river, it floated upstream. He arose and proceeded along a road which the gods had decked, and which was 1,128 cubits wide. The snakes and birds and the divinities of the woods and fields did him homage with flowers and celestial perfumes. Heavenly choirs poured forth music. The 10,000 worlds were filled with perfumes, with garlands, harmonies, and shouts of acclaim. For he was on his way to the great tree of enlightenment, the Bo tree, under which he was to redeem the universe. He placed himself with a firm resolve beneath the Bo tree on the immovable spot, and straightway was approached by Kamamara, the god of love and death. The dangerous god appeared mounted on an elephant and carrying weapons in his 1,000 hands. He was surrounded by his army, which extended 12 leagues before him, 12 to the right, 12 to the left, and in the rear as far as to the confines of the world. It was 9 leagues high. The protecting deities of the universe took flight, but the future Buddha remained unmoved beneath the tree, and the god then assailed him, seeking to break his concentration. Whirlwind, rocks, thunder and flame, smoking weapons with keen edges, burning coals, hot ashes, boiling mud, blistering sands, and 4-fold darkness, the antagonist hurled against the savior, but the missiles were all transformed into celestial flowers and ointments by the power of Gautama's 10 perfections. Mara then deployed his daughters, Desire, Pining, and Lust, surrounded by voluptuous attendants, but the mind of the great being was not distracted. The god finally challenged his right to be sitting on the immovable spot, flung his razor-sharp discus angrily, and bid the towering host of the army to let fly at him with mountain crags. But the future Buddha only moved his hand to touch the ground with his fingertips, and thus bid the goddess Earth bear witness to his right to be sitting where he was. She did so with 100,000, 100,000 roars, so that the elephant of the antagonist fell upon its knees in obeisance to the future Buddha. The army was immediately dispersed, and the gods of all the worlds scattered garlands. Having won the preliminary victory before sunset, the conqueror acquired in the first watch of the night knowledge of his previous existences, in the second watch, the divine eye of omniscient vision, and in the last watch, understanding of the chain of causation. He experienced perfect enlightenment at the break of day. Then, for 7 days, Gautama, now the Buddha, the enlightened, sat motionless in bliss. For 7 days, he stood apart and regarded the spot on which he had received enlightenment. For 7 days, he paced between the place of his sitting and the place of the standing. For 7 days, he dwelled in a pavilion furnished by the gods and reviewed the whole doctrine of causality and release. For 7 days he sat beneath the tree where the girl, Suyata, had brought him rice milk in a golden bowl, and there meditated on the doctrine of the sweetness of nirvana. He removed to another tree, and a great storm raged for 7 days. But the king of the serpents emerged from the roots of the tree and protected the Buddha with his expanded hood. Finally, the Buddha sat for 7 days beneath a fourth tree, enjoying still the sweetness of liberation. Then he doubted whether his message could be communicated, and he thought to retain the wisdom for himself. But the god Brahma descended from the zenith to implore that he should become the teacher of gods and men. And Buddha was thus persuaded to proclaim the path. And he went back into the cities of men, where he moved among the citizens of the world, bestowing the inestimable boon of the knowledge of the way. The Old Testament records a comparable deed in its legend of Moses, who in the 3rd month of the departure of Israel out of the land of Egypt, came with his people into the wilderness of Sinai. And there Israel pitched their tents over against the mountain. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called unto him from the mountain. The Lord gave to him the tables of the law, and commanded Moses to return with these to Israel, the people of the Lord. We shall have only to follow, therefore, a multitude of heroic figures through the classic stages of the universal adventure, in order to see again what has always been revealed. This will help us to understand not only the meaning of those images for contemporary life, but also the singleness of the human spirit in its aspirations, powers, vicissitudes, and wisdom. The Call to Adventure.
A hero in the Celtic myths very frequently is following an animal in the forest. The animal kind of lures him into parts of the forest he's never been in before, and then the adventure starts. Or someone will say, look, they've run off with Helen of Troy, so let's all get going and get her back again. Something may be stolen, taken away. Or someone will say, as they said to Perseus, go get Medusa's head, you can have this job. So he has to go do that. One thing or another will be the summons or call.
Long, long ago, when wishing could still lead to something, there lived a king whose daughters were all beautiful. But the youngest was so beautiful that the sun itself, who had seen so many things, simply marveled every time it shone on her face. Now close to the castle of this king was a great dark forest, and when the day was very hot, the king's child would go out into the wood, and to pass the time, she would take a golden ball, toss it up, and catch it. And this was her favorite plaything.
You know how it is. Every little girl is a princess, certainly. And every daddy is king. And she has a favorite place. And her favorite place is right at the edge of the forest. And she's sitting under a beautiful tree. That's the tree of the midpoint, between light and dark. Its roots go down, and there's a wonderful little luminous well there that goes down into the roots. So that's the abyss, the tree's up there. And what does she do there? She tosses a golden ball in the air. That's her principal play. Now, gold is the metal of immortality. It does not corrode. Gold is the solar metal. It's the color of the sun. It's the metal equivalent of the solar power. The sphere is the sphere of the perfect form. All you have to do is read your Plato, and you get that. So this is her own immortal perfection. She's tossing her soul around, so to say.
Now it so happened one day that the golden ball of the princess did not fall into the little hand lifted into the air, but passed it, bounced on the ground, and rolled directly into the water. Thereupon she began to cry, and her crying became louder and louder, and she was unable to find consolation. And while she was lamenting in this way, she heard someone call to her. What is the matter, princess? You are crying so hard. A stone would be forced to pity you. She looked around to see where the voice had come from, and beheld a frog holding its fat, ugly head out of the water. Oh, it's you, old water plopper, she said. I'm crying because my golden ball has fallen into the spring.
It slips through her dear little hands, and it goes down into the pool. She has lost her soul, and she's afflicted then by what is known as melancholy. This is the call. Life has lost its virtue. I'm on the rocks. Where is the joy of life? Clunk. So then comes the little magical aid. She's sitting there, and the being of the abyss is wakened, the frog, the little dragon. She hears the little frog voice saying, "What's the matter, little girl?" Well, she says, "I've lost my golden ball." "Well, where is it?" he says. "It dropped down in the well." "I'll get it for you," he says. "Oh, how nice," she says. "What will you give me for it?" he says. "Ho, ho, this is the beginning of trouble." "I'll give you my golden crown," she says. "I don't want your golden crown." "I'll give you my pretty silk dress." "I don't want your pretty silk dress." "Well, what do you want?" "I want to sit by you at table and eat from your golden plate. I want to go with you to your room and sleep in your silken bed." Underestimating the frog, she says, "Okay." That's the way things begin. If you knew what you were in for, you would not do it.
As soon as the frog had obtained her promise, he ducked his head and sank, and after a little while came swimming up again. He had the ball in his mouth and tossed it on the grass.
Up comes the little frog with the golden ball in his mouth. Now, anyone who remembers the ancient Chinese flag will recall the dragon with the golden sun in his mouth. This is exactly this moment of the little fairy tale. Well, she takes the golden ball and without so much as a thank you, goes tripping home. And he comes flopping after, saying, "Wait for me," but is not heard.
"Wait, wait," called the frog. "Take me along. I can't run like you." But what good did it do, though he croaked after her as loudly as he could? She paid not the slightest heed, but hurried home, and soon had completely forgotten the poor frog, who must have hopped back again into his spring. This story of the Frog King from the Grimm's Fairy Tales is an example of one of the ways in which the adventure can begin. A blunder, apparently the merest chance, reveals an unsuspected world, and the individual is drawn into a relationship with forces that are not rightly understood. As Freud has shown, blunders are not the merest chance. They are the result of suppressed desires and conflicts. They are ripples on the surface of life produced by unsuspected springs. And these may be very deep as the soul itself. The blunder may amount to the opening of a destiny. Thus it happens in this fairy tale that the disappearance of the ball is the first sign of something coming for the princess. The frog is the second, and the unconsidered promise is the third. As a preliminary manifestation of the powers that are breaking into play, the frog, coming up as it were by miracle, can be termed the herald. The crisis of his appearance is the call to adventure. The herald's summons may be to live, as in the present instance, or at a later moment of the biography, to die. It may sound the call to some high historical undertaking, or it may mark the dawn of religious illumination. As apprehended by the mystic, it marks what has been termed the awakening of the self. In the case of the princess of the fairy tale, it signified no more than the coming of adolescence. But whether great or small, and no matter what the stage or grade of life, the call rings up the curtain, always, on a mystery of transfiguration, a rite or moment of spiritual passage, which, when complete, amounts to a dying and a birth. The familiar life horizon has been outgrown, the old concepts, ideals, and emotional patterns no longer fit, the time for the passing of a threshold is at hand. This first stage of the mythological journey, which we have designated the call to adventure, signifies that destiny has summoned the hero and transferred his spiritual center of gravity from within the pale of his society to a zone unknown. This fateful region is both treasure and danger, and may be variously represented as a distant land, a forest, a kingdom underground, beneath the waves or above the sky, a secret island, lofty mountain, or profound dream state. But it is always a place of strangely fluid and polymorphous beings, unimaginable torments, superhuman deeds, and impossible delight. The hero can venture forth of his own volition to accomplish the adventure, as did Theseus when he arrived in his father's city, Athens, and heard the horrible story of the Minotaur. Or he may be carried or sent abroad by some benign or malignant agent, as was Odysseus, driven about the Mediterranean by the winds of the angered god Poseidon. The adventure may begin as a mere blunder, or still again, one may only be casually strolling when some passing phenomenon catches the wandering eye and lures one away from the frequented paths of man. Examples might be multiplied ad infinitum from every corner of the world. Refusal of the call. Often, in actual life, and not infrequently in the myths and popular tales, we encounter the dull case of the call unanswered. For it is always possible to turn the ear to other interests. Refusal of the summons converts the adventure into its negative. Walled in boredom, hard work, or culture, the subject loses the power of significant affirmative action and becomes a victim to be saved. His flowering world becomes a wasteland of dry stones, and his life feels meaningless, even though, like King Minos, he may, through titanic effort, succeed in building an empire of renown. Whatever house he builds, it will be a house of death, a labyrinth of cyclopean walls to hide from him his Minotaur. All he can do is create new problems for himself and await the gradual approach of his disintegration. The myths and folk tales of the whole world make clear that the refusal is essentially a refusal to give up what one takes to be one's own interest. The future is regarded not in terms of an unremitting series of deaths and births, but as though one's present system of ideals, virtues, goals, and advantages were to be fixed and made secure. King Minos retained the divine bull when the sacrifice would have signified submission to the will of the god of his society, for he preferred what he conceived to be his economic advantage. Thus he failed to advance into the life role that he had assumed, and we have seen with what calamitous effect. The divinity itself became his terror. For if one is oneself, one's own god, then God himself becomes a monster. These are the opening lines of Francis Thompson's The Hound of Heaven. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind, and in the mist of tears I hid from him and under running laughter. One is harassed both day and night by the divine being that is the image of the living self within the locked labyrinth of one's own distorted psyche. The ways to the gates have all been lost. There is no exit. One can only cling, like Satan, furiously to oneself and be in hell, or else break and be annihilated at last in God. Again, the Hound of Heaven. Our fondest, blindest, weakest, I am he whom thou seekest. Thou dravest love from thee who dravest me. The same harrowing, mysterious voice was to be heard in the call of the Greek god Apollo to the fleeing maiden Daphne, daughter of the river Peneus, as he pursued her over the plain. O nymph, O Peneus' daughter, stay, the deity called to her, like the frog to the princess in the fairy tale. I who pursue thee am no enemy. Thou knowest not whom thou fleest, and for that reason dost thou flee. Run with less speed, I pray, and hold thy flight. I too will follow with less speed. Nay, stop and ask who thy lover is. He would have said more, the story goes, from Ovid's Metamorphosis, but the maiden pursued her frightened way and left him with words unfinished, even in her desertion seeming fair. The winds bared her limbs, the opposing breezes set her garments aflutter as she ran, and a light air flung her locks streaming behind her. Her beauty was enhanced by flight, but the chase drew to an end, for the youthful god would not longer waste his time in coaxing words, and urged on by love, he pursued at utmost speed. Just as when a Gallic hound has seen a hare in the open plain and seeks his prey on flying feet, but the hare, safety. He, just about to fasten on her, now, even now, thinks he has her, and grazes her very heels with his outstretched muzzle, but she knows not whether or not she be already caught, and barely escapes from those sharp fangs, and leaves behind the jaws, just closing on her. So ran the god and the maid. He sped by hope, and she by fear. But he ran the more swiftly, borne on the wings of love, gave her no time to rest, hung over her fleeing shoulders, and breathed on the hair that steamed over her neck. Now was all her strength gone, and pale with fear, and utterly overcome by the toil of her swift flight, seeing the waters of her father's river near, she cried, O Father, help! If your waters hold divinity, change and destroy this beauty by which I pleased o'er well. Scarce had she thus prayed, when a down-dragging numbness seized her limbs, and her soft sides were begirt with thin bark. Her hair was changed to leaves, her arms to branches, her feet, but now so swift, grew fast in sluggish roots, and her head was now but a tree's top. Her gleaming beauty alone remained. This is indeed a dull and unrewarding finish. Apollo, the sun, the lord of time and ripeness, no longer pressed his frightening suit, but instead simply named the laurel his favorite tree, and ironically recommended its leaves to the fashioners of victory wreaths. The girl had retreated to the image of her parent and there found protection. The literature of psychoanalysis abounds in examples of such desperate fixations. What they represent is an impotence to put off the infantile ego with its sphere of emotional relationships and ideals. One is bound in by the walls of childhood. The father and mother stand as threshold guardians, and the timorous soul, fearful of some punishment, fails to make the passage through the door and come to birth in the world without. Not all who hesitate are lost. The psyche has many secrets in reserve, and these are not disclosed unless required. So it is that sometimes the predicament following an obstinate refusal of the call proves to be the occasion of a providential revelation of some unsuspected principle of release. Willed introversion, in fact, is one of the classic implements of creative genius and can be employed as a deliberate device. The result, of course, may be a disintegration of consciousness more or less complete, neurosis, psychosis, the plight of spellbound Daphne. But on the other hand, if the personality is able to absorb and integrate the new forces, there will be experienced an almost superhuman degree of self-consciousness and masterful control. This is a basic principle of the Indian disciplines of yoga. It cannot be described quite as an answer to any specific call. Rather, it is a deliberate, terrific refusal to respond to anything but the deepest, highest, richest answer to the as yet unknown demand of some waiting void within. A kind of total strike or rejection of the offered terms of life, as a result of which some power of transformation carries the problem to a plane of new magnitudes where it is suddenly and finally resolved.
Now, there are two kinds of starting out to adventure. One is the one that is yours. It has come to you in the way of an inner voice or a readiness for a certain kind of adventure. The other is following a crowd. That's not being your adventure. If it's going to be your adventure, there will appear, as you approach what I call the threshold of adventure, the threshold of real danger, getting out of bounds, there will appear a little guiding voice. I'm calling this magical aid. A little dwarf, a little animal, a little worm will say, where are you going? And you will say, such and such and such and such. And the voice will say, well, this is very dangerous. You can't do that. And you will say, yes, but I know I'm going to do it. And they'll say, well, here's a little thought to hold in your mind, or here's a little trinket to have hanging from your chest, or here's something else that's going to guide you and protect you and carry you through this journey. You're given magical aid. You're a little guide. And when you're in trouble, hang on to that, kid, and forget everything else. It's actually a fact. Your adventure is your adventure. And if it is yours, the world will open. Where other people would run into obstacles and blocks, it will open for you. You get on the road and are thumbing your way. The car that stops has the people in it that are just the ones that can carry you that distance and give you advice and perhaps a $5 bill to carry you on the rest of the way. All that kind of thing. Magical aid.
Among the American Indians of the Southwest, the favorite personage in this benign role is Spider Woman, a grandmotherly little person who lives underground. The twin war gods of the Navajo, on the way to the house of their father, the Sun, had hardly departed from their home following a holy trail when they came upon this wonderful little figure, here described in the 1897 book Navajo Legends by Washington Matthews. The boys traveled rapidly in the holy trail, and soon after sunrise, near Tsilnaotl, saw smoke arising from the ground. They went to the place where the smoke rose, and they found it came from the smoke hole of a subterranean chamber. A ladder, black from smoke, projected through the hole. Looking down into the chamber, they saw an old woman, the Spider Woman, who glanced up at them and said, "Welcome, children. Enter. Who are you? And whence do you come walking together?" They made no answer, but descended the ladder. When they reached the floor, she spoke again to them, asking, "Whither do you two go walking together?" "Nowhere in particular," they answered. "We came here because we had nowhere else to go." She asked this question four times, and each time she received a similar answer. Then she said, "Perhaps you would seek your father." "Yes," they answered, "if we only knew the way to his dwelling." "Ah," said the woman, "it is a long and dangerous way to the house of your father, the Sun. There are many monsters dwelling between here and there, and perhaps, when you get there, your father may not be glad to see you and may punish you for coming. You must pass four places of danger: the rocks that crush the traveler, the reeds that cut into pieces, the cane cactuses that tear him to pieces, and the boiling sands that overwhelm him. But I shall give you something to subdue your enemies and preserve your lives." She gave them a charm called Feather of the Alien Gods, which consisted of a hoop with two feathers plucked from a living eagle attached, and another life feather to preserve their existence. She taught them also this magic formula, which, if repeated to their enemies, would subdue their anger: "Put your feet down with pollen. Put your hands down with pollen. Put your head down with pollen. Then your feet are pollen. Your hands are pollen. Your body is pollen. Your mind is pollen. Your voice is pollen. The trail is beautiful. Be still." The helpful crone and fairy godmother is a familiar feature of European fairy lore. In Christian saints' legends, the role is commonly played by the Virgin. The Virgin, by her intercession, can win the mercy of the Father. Spider Woman, with her web, can control the movements of the Sun. The hero who has come under the protection of the Cosmic Mother cannot be harmed. The thread of Ariadne brought Theseus safely through the adventure of the labyrinth. This is the guiding power that runs through the work of Dante in the female figures of Beatrice and the Virgin, and appears in Goethe's Faust, successively as Gretchen, Helen of Troy, and the Virgin. "Thou art the living font of hope," prays Dante at the end of his safe passage through the perils of the three worlds. "Lady, thou art so great and so availest that whoso would have grace and has not recourse to thee would have his desire fly without wings. Thy benign grace not only sustains him who asks, but oftentimes freely foreruns the asking. In thee mercy, in thee pity, in thee magnificence, in thee whatever of goodness is in any creature, are united." What such a figure represents is the benign, protecting power of destiny. The fantasy is a reassurance, a promise that the peace of paradise, which was known first within the mother womb, is not to be lost, that it supports the present and stands in the future as well as in the past. One has only to know and trust, and the ageless guardians will appear. Having responded to his own call and continuing to follow courageously as the consequences unfold, the hero finds all the forces of the unconscious at his side. Mother Nature herself supports the mighty task, and insofar as the hero's act coincides with that for which his society itself is ready, he seems to ride on the great rhythm of the historical process. "I feel myself," said Napoleon at the opening of his Russian campaign, "driven toward an end that I do not know. As soon as I shall have reached it, as soon as I shall have become unnecessary, an atom will suffice to shatter me. Till then, not all the forces of mankind can do anything against me." Not infrequently, the supernatural helper is masculine in form. In fairy lore, it may be some little fellow of the wood, some wizard, hermit, shepherd, or smith, who appears to supply the amulets and advice that the hero will require. The higher mythologies develop the role in the great figure of the guide, the teacher, the ferryman, the conductor of souls to the afterworld. In classical myth, this is Hermes Mercury. In Egyptian, usually Thoth, the ibis god, the baboon god. In Christian, the Holy Ghost. Goethe presents the masculine guide in Faust as Mephistopheles, and not infrequently, the dangerous aspect of the mercurial figure is stressed. For he is the lurer of the innocent soul into realms of trial. In Dante's vision, the part is played by Virgil, who yields to be a tree tree at the threshold of paradise. Protective and dangerous, motherly and fatherly at the same time, this supernatural principle of guardianship and direction unites in itself all the ambiguities of the unconscious. The hero to whom such a helper appears is typically one who has responded to the call. The call, in fact, was the first announcement of the approach of this initiatory priest. But even to those who apparently have hardened their hearts, the supernatural guardian may appear. The crossing of the first threshold.
Then you come to the edge of the world. That place psychologically that no one has ever explored for you. That you have to do on your very own. And this I call the threshold of adventure. Before that, you're in more or less mapped out territory. There are a number of typical crises representing this point. What emerges to confront you is the absolute danger of darkness. This will be represented in the form of an typical creature, a dragon, a whale. And in the Arthurian romances, also often a knight in black armor with visor down, so it's just this impersonal monster. And when he is defeated and the visor is taken off, he's the hero's brother.
With the personifications of his destiny to guide and aid him, the hero goes forward in his adventure until he comes to the threshold guardian, at the entrance to the zone of magnified power. Such custodians bound the world in the four directions, also up and down, standing for the limits of the hero's present sphere, or life horizon. Beyond them is darkness, the unknown, and danger. Just as beyond the parental watch is danger to the infant, and beyond the protection of his society, danger to the member of the tribe. The usual person is more than content, he is even proud to remain within the indicated bounds. Thus, the sailors of the bold vessels of Columbus, breaking the horizon of the medieval mind, sailing, as they thought, into the boundless ocean of immortal being that surrounds the cosmos, like an endless mythological serpent biting its tail, had to be cozened and urged on like children because of their fear of the fabled leviathans, mermaids, dragon kings, and other monsters of the deep. The folk mythologies populate with deceitful and dangerous presences every desert place outside the normal traffic of the village. For example, the Hottentots describe an ogre that has been occasionally encountered among the scrubs and dunes. Its eyes are set on its instep, so that to discover what is going on, it has to get down on hands and knees and hold up one foot. The eye then looks behind. Otherwise, it is gazing continually at the sky. This monster is a hunter of men, whom it tears to shreds with cruel teeth as long as fingers. The creature is said to hunt in packs. Another Hottentot apparition, the Hai-Uri, progresses by leaping over clumps of scrub instead of going around them. A dangerous, one-legged, one-armed, one-sided figure, the half-man, invisible if viewed from the offside, is encountered in many parts of the earth. In Central Africa, it is declared that such a half-man says to the person who has encountered him, "Since you have met with me, let us fight together." If thrown, he will plead, "Do not kill me. I will show you lots of medicines." And then the lucky person becomes a proficient doctor. But if the half-man, called Chiruwi, a mysterious thing, wins, his victim dies. I dreamed, stated a middle-aged married gentleman in Wilhelm Steckel's book, Fortschritte und Technik der Traumdeutung, that I wanted to get into a wonderful garden. But before it, there was a watchman who would not permit me to enter. I saw that my friend, Fräulein Elsa, was within. She wanted to reach me her hand over the gate, but the watchman prevented that, took me by the arm, and conducted me home. "Do be sensible, after all," he said. "You know you mustn't do that." This is a dream that brings out the sense of the first or protective aspect of the threshold guardian. One had better not challenge the watcher of the established bounds. And yet, it is only by advancing beyond those bounds, provoking the destructive other aspect of the same power, that the individual passes, either alive or in death, into a new zone of experience. In the language of the pygmies of the Andaman Islands, the word Okujumu, one who speaks from dreams, designates those highly respected and feared individuals who are distinguished from their fellows by the possession of supernatural talents, which can be acquired only by meeting with the spirits, directly in the jungle, through extraordinary dream, or by death and return. The adventure is always and everywhere a passage beyond the veil of the known into the unknown. The powers that watch at the boundary are dangerous. To deal with them is risky. Yet for anyone with competence and courage, the danger fades. Adapted with slight abridgment from the translation of Eugene Watson Burlingame's Buddhist Parables comes a story of a young prince who had just completed his military studies under a world-renowned teacher. Having received as a symbol of his distinction the title Prince Five Weapons, he accepted the five weapons that his teacher gave him, bowed, and, armed with the new weapons, struck out onto the road leading to the city of his father, the king. On the way, he came to a certain forest. People at the mouth of the forest warned him, "Sir Prince, do not enter this forest," they said. "An ogre lives here named Sticky Hair. He kills every man he sees." But the prince was confident and fearless as a maned lion. He entered the forest just the same. When he reached the heart of it, the ogre showed himself. The ogre had increased his stature to the height of a palm tree. He had created for himself a head as big as a summer house, with bell-shaped pinnacle, eyes as big as alms bowls, two tusks as big as giant bulbs or buds. He had the beak of a hawk. His belly was covered with blotches. His hands and feet were dark green. "Where are you going?" he demanded. "Halt! You are my prey." Prince Five Weapons answered without fear, but with great confidence in the arts and crafts that he had learned. "Ogre," said he, "I know what I was about when I entered this forest. You would do well to be careful about attacking me, for with an arrow steeped in poison, I will pierce your flesh and fell you on the spot." Having thus threatened the ogre, the young prince fitted to his bow an arrow steeped in deadly poison and let fly. It stuck right in the ogre's hair. Then he let fly one after another 50 arrows. All stuck right to the ogre's hair. The ogre shook off every one of those arrows, letting them fall right at his feet, and approached the young prince. Prince Five Weapons threatened the ogre a second time, and drawing his sword, delivered a masterly blow. The sword, 33 inches long, stuck right to the ogre's hair. Then the prince smote him with a spear. That also stuck right to his hair. Perceiving that the spear had stuck, he smote him with a club. That also stuck right to his hair. When he saw that the club had stuck, he said, "Master Ogre, you have never heard of me before. I am Prince Five Weapons. When I entered this forest infested by you, I took no account of bows and such like weapons. When I entered this forest, I took account only of myself. Now I am going to beat you and pound you into powder and dust." Having thus made known his determination, with a yell he struck the ogre with his right hand. His hand stuck right to the ogre's hair. He struck him with his left hand. That also stuck. He struck him with his right foot. That also stuck. He struck him with his left foot. That also stuck. Thought he, "I will beat you with my head and pound you into powder and dust." He struck him with his head. That also stuck right to the ogre's hair. Prince Five Weapons snared five times, stuck fast in five places, dangled from the ogre's body. But for all that, he was unafraid, undaunted. As for the ogre, he thought, "This is some lion of a man, some man of noble birth, no mere man. For although he has been caught by an ogre like me, he appears neither to tremble nor to quake. In all the time I have harried this road, I have never, never seen a single man to match him. Why, pray, is he not afraid?" Not daring to eat him, he asked, Youth, why are you not afraid? Why are you not terrified with the fear of death? Ogre, why should I be afraid? For in one life, one death is absolutely certain. What's more, I have in my belly a thunderbolt for weapon. If you eat me, you will not be able to digest that weapon. It will tear your insides to tatters and fragments and will kill you. In that case, we'll both perish. That's why I'm not afraid. Prince Five Weapons, the listener must know, was referring to the weapon of knowledge that was within him. Indeed, this young hero was none other than the future Buddha in an earlier incarnation. What this youth says is true, thought the ogre, terrified with the fear of death. From the body of this lion of a man, my stomach would not be able to digest a fragment of flesh, even so small as a kidney bean. I'll let him go. And he let Prince Five Weapons go. The future Buddha preached the doctrine to him, subdued him, made him self-denying, and then transformed him into a spirit entitled to receive offerings in the forest. Having admonished the ogre to be heedful, the youth departed from the forest, and at the mouth of the forest told his story to human beings, then went his way. As a symbol of the world to which the five senses glue us, and which cannot be pressed aside by the actions of the physical organs, Sticky Hair was subdued only when the future Buddha, no longer protected by the five weapons of his momentary name and physical character, resorted to the unnamed, invisible sixth. The divine thunderbolt of the knowledge of the transcendent principle, which is beyond the phenomenal realm of names and forms. Therewith, the situation changed. He was no longer caught, but released, for that which he now remembered himself to be is ever free. The force of the monster of phenomenality was dispelled, and he was rendered self-denying. Self-denying, he became divine, a spirit entitled to receive offerings, as is the world itself when known, not as final, but as a mere name and form of that which transcends, yet is immanent within all names and forms. The Belly of the Whale.
In the whale's belly, the hero goes into the abyss alive. In the crucifixion, he goes in dead. The cross, I've told you, is the symbol of the world. He goes through the cross, goes through the midpoint, leaves the four dimensions behind him, goes through the midpoint, the sun door. This is the image of the what the Germans call the Klapfelsen, the Simpleiades, the clashing rocks, the pair of opposites, good and evil, true and false, this and that. You're going through it. You go through just at the moment when the crash comes.
The idea that the passage of the magical threshold is a transit into a sphere of rebirth is symbolized in the worldwide womb image of the belly of the whale. The hero, instead of conquering or conciliating the power of the threshold, is swallowed into the unknown and would appear to have died. From Longfellow's book, The Song of Hiawatha. Mishelama, king of fishes, in his wrath he darted upward, flashing, leaped into the sunshine, opened his great jaws and swallowed both canoe and Hiawatha. The Eskimo of the Bering Strait tell of the trickster hero Raven, how one day, as he sat drying his clothes on a beach, he observed a whale cow swimming gravely close to shore. He called, "Next time you come up for air, dear, open your mouth and shut your eyes." Then he slipped quickly into his raven clothes, pulled on his raven mask, gathered his fire sticks under his arm, and flew out over the water. The whale came up. She did as she had been told. Raven darted through the open jaws and straight into her gullet. The shocked whale cow snapped and sounded. Raven stood inside and looked around. The Zulus have a story of two children and their mother swallowed by an elephant. When the woman reached the animal's stomach, she saw large forests and great rivers and many high lands. On one side there were many rocks, and there were many people who had built their village there, and many dogs and many cattle. All was there inside the elephant. The Irish hero, Finn MacCool, was swallowed by a monster of indefinite form, of the type known to the Celtic world as a paste. The little German girl Red Riding Hood was swallowed by a wolf. The Polynesian favorite, Maui, was swallowed by his great-great-grandmother, Hinenue Tepo, and the whole Greek pantheon, with the exception of Zeus, was swallowed by its father, Kronos. The Greek hero Heracles, pausing at Troy on his way homeward with the belt of the Queen of the Amazons, found that the city was being harassed by a monster sent against it by the sea god Poseidon. The beast would come ashore and devour people as they moved about on the plain. Beautiful Hesione, the daughter of the king, had just been bound by her father to the sea rocks as a propitiatory sacrifice, and the great visiting hero agreed to rescue her for a price. The monster, in due time, broke to the surface of the water and opened its enormous maw. Heracles took a dive into the throat, cut his way out through the belly, and left the monster dead. This popular motif gives emphasis to the lesson that the passage of the threshold is a form of self-annihilation. Instead of passing outward, beyond the confines of the visible world, the hero goes inward to be born again. The disappearance corresponds to the passing of a worshipper into a temple, where he is to be quickened by the recollection of who and what he is, namely, dust and ashes, unless immortal. The temple interior, the belly of the whale, and the heavenly land beyond, above, and below the confines of the world, are one and the same. That is why the approaches and entrances of temples are flanked and defended by colossal gargoyles, dragons, lions, devil slayers with drawn swords, resentful dwarfs, winged bulls. These are the threshold guardians to ward away all incapable of encountering the higher silences within. They are preliminary embodiments of the dangerous aspect of the presence, corresponding to the mythological ogres that bound the conventional world, or to the two rows of teeth of the whale. They illustrate the fact that the devotee at the moment of entry into a temple undergoes a metamorphosis. His secular character remains without. He sheds it, as a snake sheds its skin. Once inside, he may be said to have died to time and returned to the world womb, the world navel, the earthly paradise. The mere fact that anyone can physically walk past the temple guardians does not invalidate their significance, for if the intruder is incapable of encompassing the sanctuary, then he has effectually remained without. Anyone unable to understand a god sees it as a devil, and is thus defended from the approach. Allegorically, then, the passage into a temple and the hero dives through the jaws of the whale are identical ventures, both denoting, in picture language, the life-centering, life-renewing act. Ananda Kumaraswamy writes, "No creature can attain a higher grade of nature without ceasing to exist." Indeed, the physical body of the hero may be actually slain, dismembered, and scattered over the land or sea, as in the Egyptian myth of the savior Osiris. He was thrown into a sarcophagus and committed to the Nile by his brother Set, and when he returned from the dead, his brother slew him again, tore the body into 14 pieces, and scattered those over the land. The twin heroes of the Navajo had to pass not only the clashing rocks, but also the reeds that cut the traveler to pieces, the cane cactuses that tear him to pieces, and the boiling sands that overwhelm him. The hero whose attachment to ego is already annihilated passes back and forth across the horizons of the world, in and out of the dragon, as readily as a king through all the rooms of his house. And therein lies his power to save, for his passing and returning demonstrate that through all the contraries of phenomenality, the uncreate, imperishable remains, and there is nothing to fear. Initiation, beginning with the road of trials. Once having traversed the threshold, the hero moves in a dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms, where he must survive a succession of trials. This is a favorite phase of the myth adventure. It has produced a world literature of miraculous tests and ordeals. The hero is covertly aided by the advice, amulets, and secret agents of the supernatural helper, whom he met before his entrance into this region. Or it may be that here he discovers for the first time that there is a benign power everywhere supporting him in his superhuman passage. One of the best known and most charming examples of the difficult tasks motif is that of Psyche's quest for her lost lover Cupid. Here, all the principal roles are reversed. Instead of the lover trying to win his bride, it is the bride trying to win her lover. And instead of a cruel father withholding his daughter from the lover, it is the jealous mother, Venus, hiding her son, Cupid, from his bride. When Psyche pleaded with Venus, the goddess grasped her violently by the hair and dashed her head upon the ground, then took a great quantity of wheat, barley, millet, poppy seeds, peas, lentils, and beans, mingled all these together in a heap, and commanded the girl to sort them before night. Psyche was aided by an army of ants. Venus told her next to gather the golden wool of certain dangerous sheep, sharp of horn and poisonous of bite, that inhabited an inaccessible valley in a dangerous wood. But a green reed instructed her how to gather from the reeds round about the golden locks shed by the sheep in their passage. The goddess now required a bottle of water from a freezing spring high on a towering rock beset by sleepless dragons. An eagle approached and accomplished the marvelous task. Psyche was ordered finally to bring from the abyss of the underworld a box full of supernatural beauty. But a high tower told her how to go down to the world below, gave her coins for Charon and sops for Cerberus, and sped her on her way. If anyone, in whatever society, undertakes for himself the perilous journey into the darkness by descending, either intentionally or unintentionally, into the crooked lanes of his own spiritual labyrinth, he soon finds himself in a landscape of symbolical figures, any one of which may swallow him. In the vocabulary of the mystics, this is the second stage of the way, the purification of the self, when the senses are cleaned and humbled, and the energies and interests concentrated upon transcendental things. This is the process of dissolving, transcending, or transmuting the infantile images of our personal past. In our dreams, the ageless perils, gargoyles, trials, secret helpers, and instructive figures are nightly still encountered, and in their forms we may see reflected not only the whole picture of our present case, but also the clue to what we must do to be saved. There can be no question, the psychological dangers through which earlier generations were guided by the symbols and spiritual exercises of their mythological and religious inheritance, we today must face alone, or, at best, with only tentative, impromptu, and not often very effective guidance. This is our problem as modern, enlightened individuals, for whom all gods and devils have been rationalized out of existence. Nevertheless, in the multitude of myths and legends that have been preserved to us, or collected from the ends of the earth, we may yet see delineated something of our still human course. To hear and profit, however, one may have to submit somehow to purgation and surrender, and that is part of our problem, just how to do it. As it says in the Koran, "Or do ye think that ye shall enter the garden of bliss without trials as came to those who passed away before you?" The original departure into the land of trials represented only the beginning of the long and really perilous path of initiatory conquests and moments of illumination. Dragons have now to be slain, and surprising barriers passed, again and again and again. Meanwhile, there will be a multitude of preliminary victories, unretainable ecstasies, and momentary glimpses of that wonderful land. The meeting with the goddess.
And now we come to the critical crisis. Now, this is rendered in four different ways, each way representing a sort of style of thought, a mood or mode, a style of mythology. Put them down as A, B, C, D. A is the Hieros Gamos, the sacred marriage. That is to say, the union of pairs of opposites in male-female terms. The hero marries the goddess. The nymph is married to the god. This is the virgin birth motif. The symbology of pairs of opposites united, of temporal and eternal principles identified, is rendered in terms of the sexual polarity. This is the way of most of the fairy tales, many of the classical myths, infinite number of Oriental myths, and so forth.
The ultimate adventure, when all the barriers and ogres have been overcome, is commonly represented as a mystical marriage of the triumphant hero soul with the queen goddess of the world. This is the crisis at the nadir, the zenith, or at the utmost edge of the earth, at the central point of the cosmos, in the tabernacle of the temple, or within the darkness of the deepest chamber of the heart. In the west of Ireland, they still tell the tale of the Prince of the Lonesome Isle and the Lady of Tubertintai. Hoping to heal the Queen of Erin, the heroic youth had undertaken to go for 3 bottles of the water of Tubertintai, the flaming fairy well. Following the advice of a supernatural aunt whom he encountered on the way, and riding a wonderful, dirty, lean, little shaggy horse that she gave to him, he crossed a river of fire and escaped the touch of a grove of poison trees. The horse, with the speed of the wind, shot past the end of the castle of Tubertintai. The prince sprang from its back through an open window and came down inside, safe and sound. In the words of Jeremiah Curtin from his book Myths and Folklore of Ireland, "The whole place, enormous in extent, was filled with sleeping giants and monsters of sea and land, great whales, long slippery eels, bears and beasts of every form and kind. The prince passed through them and over them till he came to the great stairway. At the head of the stairway he went into a chamber where he found the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, stretched out on a couch, asleep. 'I'll have nothing to say to you,' thought he, and went on to the next. And so he looked into 12 chambers. In each was a woman more beautiful than the one before. But when he reached the 13th chamber and opened the door, the flash of gold took the sight from his eyes. He stood a while till the sight came back and then entered. In the great, bright chamber was a golden couch, resting on wheels of gold. The wheels turned continually. The couch went round and round, never stopping, night or day. On the couch lay the queen of Tubertintai, and if her 12 maidens were beautiful, they would not be beautiful if seen near her. At the foot of the couch was Tubertintai itself, the well of fire. There was a golden cover upon the well, and it went around continually with the couch of the queen. 'Upon my word,' said the prince, 'I'll rest here a while.' And he went up on the couch and never left it for 6 days and nights. The Lady of the House of Sleep is a familiar figure in fairy tale and myth. She is the paragon of all paragons of beauty, the reply to all desire, the bliss-bestowing goal of every hero's earthly and unearthly quest. She is mother, sister, mistress, bride. Whatever in the world has lured, whatever has seemed to promise joy, she is the incarnation of the promise of perfection, the soul's assurance that at the conclusion of its exile in a world of organized inadequacies, the bliss that was once known will be known again. The comforting, the nourishing, the good mother, young and beautiful, who was known to us and even tasted in the remotest past. Time sealed her away, yet she is dwelling still, like one who sleeps in timelessness at the bottom of the timeless sea."